and the emergency mindset of surviving Hurricane Maria. We want everything we do to build towards a new world, a new, more just, more equal society. We want to empower people to build popular power and gain more skills in terms of education, preparation, and resistance so we can be in a better state for creating and proposing new ideas.
Preparación y resistencia para ellos poder estar en una mejor condición de construir y proponer.
They also put on musical performances and plays. This episode was written, produced, and edited by Robert Raymond. Interviews were conducted and recorded by our field producer, Juan Carlos Davila. A big thank you to Vladi, Skew One, and Papel Machete for the music.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 18, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, Rachel Hartley, and Janka Soderberg. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Danielle Parks. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Leslie McLam. Coming up in the morning on KBOO, February 19th, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe and Joe take your calls on the issues of the day. At 9, on Alternative Radio, Nobel Peace Prize nominated author David Swanson speaks on the abolition of war. At 10, on Flashpoints, Dennis Bernstein looks at a breaking news issues of the day. At 11, on Stage and Studio, Susanna Mars speaks with writer and actor Anya Pearson and director Jamie M. Ray about Made to Dance in Burning Buildings. At Shaking the Tree Theater, their work poses the question, how do we heal from trauma? At 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Galavan interviews photographer Sarah Graves about her work for the Portland Grid Project. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by member support. To become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on the button marked Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor, Demilitarizing the Pacific, on Wednesday, February 20th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Peace House in Portland. Demilitarizing the Pacific features three indigenous women speaking on the destruction of a coral reef to expand a military base in Japan, curbing military buildup in Guam, and peace and justice in Hawaii. Again, that's Demilitarizing the Pacific on Wednesday, February 20th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Peace House, 2116 Northeast 18th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Time is 6:03, and you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. The news has been brought to you by Portland Five Centers for the Arts, presenting traditional Irish folk band The Chieftains, February 20th at the Newmark Theater. Tickets and more information online at portland5.com. Coming up next is Labor Radio, followed by Prison Pipeline, so stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series. Every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater, Monday, February 18th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Do the Right Thing, the Spike Lee joint which follows a Brooklyn neighborhood's racial tension on a hot summer day. Again, Do the Right Thing, showing Monday, February 18th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening. This is Labor Radio. I am your host, Michael Cathcart. Thank you for tuning in, and I appreciate you continuing to listen tonight. I will be discussing a number of things, but before we get to anything that I want to cover news-wise, I would just like to give a quick shout-out to my friend. He's going through a tough time right now, but Sean, if you're out there, I'm thinking about you, and I'm sending you my thoughts and prayers and all my best, so hope everything is going well for you, man. But anyways, moving on from that, there's a number of things happening in the labor world, but something that I think cannot be ignored right now is we've seen it, you know, time and again, have discussed it a bunch of times in this show, but there's a new effort to implement right to work in a new sector of the economy in this country. As we saw a few years ago, you know, there was a wave of different states implementing right to work. Right to work laws, of course, basically gut the power of unions. They kneecap unions, and it's a kind of a right-wing dream to basically take away the provision that allows or that requires workers working in unionized workplaces to pay dues to the union that then will turn around and represent them regardless. So we've seen this happen a bunch. It's, you know, it's an effort that's come in different forms in a number of different states, particularly in the Midwest and the Rust Belt areas. But more recently, last year, we saw the implementation, or I guess the ruling, the Supreme Court ruling in the Janus v. AFSCME case. I believe it came in about June of 2018, but that essentially took out the last, or was a full frontal attack on the last vestige, or the true power center in American organized labor, and that is the public sector unions. So that essentially put in the right to work laws within public sector unions, meaning that workers who work in a unionized workplace within a government job do not have to pay the fees required for the union, but the union will still collectively bargain on their behalf and represent them, regardless of whether or not they're getting paid. So we saw that now, you know, that happened, the dust settled on that, and we knew, you know, it was clear that was not the end game for the folks who are looking to attack labor strength. And there is now a new attack that's reared its ugly head. And that's taking place in the transportation sector, particularly in airline and railroad workers. There's a new lawsuit that was just filed, I believe it was last month, in the state of New Jersey, and it's a lawsuit that is taking on the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, which is a union within the AFL-CIO. The case is called Rizzo-Rupon International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. And this lawsuit basically is trying to implement right to work for anyone who, all the workers who work within that union, within that unionized workplace in railroads, freight rail, and airlines. So the case is being filed officially or on the behalf of three United Airlines customer service agents, you know, the folks who work at the ticketing desks. But it is being pushed, you know, being supported in the background by an organization called Mackinac Center for Public Policy, which, if you haven't heard of, then I will go into a little bit of detail in a minute about them, but they are notorious for these types of attacks. Anyways, the specific case is taking on the provisions within the law that governs those types of workers, which is the Railway Labor Act. And, you know, because the law was initially passed years before airline travel existed, airline travel was just rolled into that act. But essentially, that is the law that allows that oversees. It's an act that governs unionization and collective bargaining of hundreds of thousands of union members working for railroads and airlines. So, you know, we're talking flight attendants, Amtrak conductors, freight train engineers, and a number of other employees in that same vein. So the lawsuit was filed in January, and it's basically just Janus 2.0. Now that ruling, the Janus ruling, if you don't remember, came down on a 5-4, basically along, you know, ideological lines within the Supreme Court. And that, you know, that's we're still seeing reverberations from that a year out, or a year later from that. So if in this case, in the Rizzo-Rupon case, which is a much harder name to wrap your head around than Janus was, so it hasn't caught on quite as much yet. But if the judge rules in favor of the plaintiffs in this, in the customer or the United Airlines customer service agents, then the union will still be required to represent everyone within that unionized workplace, but members can opt out of paying the dues or the fees that are required of the union, and railroad and airline workers would effectively be working within a right-to-work environment. So that is, you know, it's a major development. It thus far, it is only a lawsuit within state court, you know, circuit. I don't know exactly which circuit, circuit court within the state of New Jersey. But if, you know, if it's ruled, really, if it's ruled either way, if it's ruled in favor of, you know, the union, or if it's ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, it can be appealed. And if it's appealed, you know, it could make its way all the way to the Supreme Court, just like Janus did. And if that were the case, it's an unfortunate situation for those of us rooting for the union, because, as we know, we now have two new justices on the Supreme Court, both of which have proven track records of being anti-labor, against labor. So it's very likely that anything coming in front of the Supreme Court that has to do with organized labor and strengthening or continuing to allow the strength of unions in workplaces is not going to be ruled unfavorably by the Supreme Court, unfortunately. So, you know, that's just something to keep an eye on. But as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, this is a case brought on officially by these customer service agents. But really, it's actually just another front in the all-out assault on organized labor being perpetrated by the sort of dark money right-wing organizations. You know, most notably groups like ALEC and the Koch brothers, you know, Koch brother funded network. But this group, Mackinac Center for Public Policy, is another planet in the orbit around the Koch brother foundation and the Koch brother dark money web. And so just to give you a little background on who this organization is, and they have a long history attacks on workers and attacks on civil liberties and things like that. But the Center for Media and Democracy described them as a right-wing pressure group based in Michigan, founded in 1987. It's the largest state-level think tank in the nation. It was established by right-wing activists to promote free markets, pro-business policies. The center voices its policy positions through publications and has moved beyond Michigan helping leaders of similar conservative institutions to ratchet up their operations in many other states and countries around the world. It's a member of the State Network, State Policy Network, which is a web of state pressure groups that denote themselves as think tanks, you know, in quotes, think tanks. And they drive a right-wing agenda in state houses and often state houses nationwide. The leading academics have criticized the center, the Mackinac Center, saying that Mackinac Center research is often low quality, and because of this, it should be treated with considerable skepticism by the public, policymakers, and political leaders. Much of the work that the Mackinac Center may have caused more confusion than clarity in the public discussion of issues that it's been addressing. And by systematically ignoring evidence that it doesn't agree with, it just basically further muddies the waters. So they, you know, along with being funded by a lot of dark money and a lot of, you know, right-wing billionaires, they're also part of ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council, which basically is an organization we've covered before on the show, but they mix legislators with corporate lobbyists, and, you know, potential new laws get passed from the lobbyists directly to the legislatures, and then they take them back to their states and state houses and implement them or attempt to implement them. It's where we got the Stand Your Ground laws, which, you know, was made famous in the horrible case in Florida, the Trayvon Martin incident. And, of course, you know, they brought us many other things, including right to work as a concept and as laws in various states across the country. So, you know, a member of that, you know, one of the governors that actually did sign right to work into law in his state is Rick Snyder, who he's no longer the governor of Michigan, but he was beginning in 2011 or 2012, I believe. But either way, the Mackinac Center were a major, you know, they are based in Michigan, and they are a major proponent of right to work. And they essentially, you know, were one of the major reasons why Rick Snyder actually did pass that in the state of Michigan in 2012. The Mackinac Center created publications such as Michigan Capital Confidential and Watchdog Wire Michigan, to publish pro-right-to-work content and pressure the governor to support the law. They also, after the Janus ruling last year, they created a group, a front group essentially called My Pay, My Say, which was worked to try and convince public sector workers to opt out of unions. Once the ruling was handed down and they were allowed to do so, that group basically tried to convince workers to go against their own interests and to opt out. They would create explainer videos, you know, about the decision, trying to just help folks, you know, claiming that they were trying to help folks navigate the new decision, but really they were trying to help them navigate into opting out of their union. Another thing that they did, which I think is, as terrible as that is, this is even more egregious, and they were partially responsible, and they will claim zero responsibility for the horrible water crisis in the city of Flint, Michigan. They were major proponents, and they have been for a long time, ever since their founding, of the emergency manager system, or implementation of emergency managers in the case of economic hardships or financial crises. And in 2012, they basically provided Governor Snyder with the script, legislative script, that was the law to expand the powers of emergency managers. They passed that to him, allowed him, you know, to put his own name on it. And then they went about, while passing the law to him, they also went about through their different publications putting pressure on him to pass the laws expanding the powers of emergency managers. The expanded powers, the laws that they'd written out, included the ability to break union contracts and revise municipal charters, while getting legal immunity from any receiving legal immunity from any liability as the result of their actions. So they used the financial distress in Michigan to the financial distress that the public schools, districts, and local city governments were under to pressure the governor. He then he implemented the laws and appointed emergency managers in charge of a few different cities, and that is, of course, as we know, what led to the switching of the Flint water system off of the water from Lake Huron and from the city of Detroit and onto the Flint River, which was full of lead and poisoned pretty much everyone in that city. So that is, you know, that's just one thing that they were involved in. There's a number of other things. But what's interesting about that particular instance is that, so they, you know, that's the history of how they were directly tied to the implementation of right to work. On the back end of it, once the crisis blew up and once it became a national emergency, once, you know, the national media got a hold of it, they tried to distance themselves from it. They declined to admit even the possibility that the policies they'd pushed for played any role in the crisis. And without a hint of irony, they praised the work of the ACLU and Michigan Public Radio for exposing state officials' attempts to ignore and cover up the crisis. So, the, you know, instead of owning what they'd done or being held to account, they actually used this situation, this crisis, to bolster their, you know, ongoing, their running narrative that government is incompetent and corrupt. So they, on the front end, they created a situation, distanced themselves from it, and then used the ensuing crisis to further push for a extreme ideological narrative, push their extreme ideological narrative, and pointing back to a situation they created as reasoning for why they think government is bad. So, you know, it's unfortunately a story that we've heard over and over again, but the organization Mackinac Center, not only are they, you know, pushing the, these different extreme right-wing policies, but they also, you know, they're opposed to environmental protections and opposed to renewable energy. And not only that, but they actively promote climate change denial because they are a think tank. They support works of, you know, they support the work of noted climate change deniers. They're staunch advocates for privatization of all economic sectors, including private prisons and privatizing education. And in Michigan, of course, you have the DeVos family. Betsy DeVos is now our education secretary, and so there is a deep history of charter schools and privatization of education in the state of Michigan, and this organization is tied in very closely with that effort. And, you know, so on top of all of that, they're, of course, funded, you know, they're major funders, along with a bunch of, you know, organizations that we'd never heard of, but, you know, give hundreds of thousands of dollars. Some of the major funders are the Koch Family Foundation, so that's Charles and David Koch, the Koch brothers, the DeVos Family Foundation, which, of course, is Betsy DeVos, ExxonMobil Foundation, the Walton Family Foundation, which are the folks who are the heirs to the Walmart fortune, and, of course, the Heritage Foundation, which is an extreme right-wing Christian organization that pushes for, among other things, you know, anti-abortion laws and the like. So this is a situation to keep our eye on. It's hard to say how the judge will rule, and, you know, there's not enough information in how this, what the defense on the part of the union is going to be. But if, in fact, the judge does rule in favor of the plaintiffs, we could see another sector of our economy under attack and right to work for, I don't know that I have the exact numbers, but, you know, there have to be over hundreds of thousands of workers within the railroad and airline industry that would immediately be, the unions would be weakened, and those workers would be left without a strong bargaining partner on their side of the table. So that's an unfortunate situation to keep our eye on. Moving along, just because it is almost the end of my time here, I have a special report to play for you here. We were just talking about Ask Me. This is a report from Ask Me Local 88 steward and KBOO programmer Joe Clement, and it's about the campaign to unionize on-call and temp workers in Multnomah County. So please enjoy this this pre-recorded segment here.
You may know that the majority of Multnomah County workers are represented by the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, or AFSCME, Local 88. Having the union is part of why the county can be a great place to work. It fights for our wages, our work conditions, but also our dignity on and off the job. That's what hundreds of on-call and temp workers said when they signed up to be a part of AFSCME Local 88 2 years ago. On-call and temp workers haven't been part of the union. That means they don't get regular wage increases, even if they've been working for years, as many on-calls have. Even though they're legally entitled to sick leave, there's still the lingering threat of retaliation through the plausibly deniable exercise of the employer's prerogative. On-call workers don't get health insurance, they don't get paid on holidays even if it's a day they would have been scheduled, or if a natural event like the snow, quote-unquote, storm we had a couple weeks ago closes facilities, like it did at the libraries, on-call and temp workers don't get paid like the rest of us. And on-call and temp workers don't get a bus pass like regular county workers do, even though their job, by the nature of it, sometimes means appearing at different parts of the county different days of the week. And so, over 2 years ago, majority of on-call and temp workers signed cards with AFSCME Local 88 to join the bargaining unit. One of the baked-in pro-boss features of our labor law is that the county, as the employer, gets to refuse whether this is recognized. And that's exactly what the county did, or at least its labor relations apparatus. The union took the county to arbitration, and the county argued that the on-call and temp workers don't share a quote-unquote community of interests with regular workers, which is to say, they don't really do the same things. And an arbitration judge agreed with the county in April of last year, but the Oregon Employment Relations Board ordered another hearing to be held on January 8th of this year. Before that, in November of last year, a large contingent of on-call and temp workers, organizers, and their supporters showed up at a county board meeting to demand that the commissioners recognize the on-calls and temps into the union. After giving public testimony, some of which included pointing out that the county already recognizes on-call juvenile custody service specialists, the block left en masse, having a noticeable effect. In December, on-call and temp workers proposed to the county that they recognize the union and set some terms. Then, the county began to cave. They sent a counterproposal, implicitly starting to recognize the on-call and temp workers' claims. The county's proposal includes many things that the workers have demanded, including regular pay increases, vacation time, a differential to offset the cost of medical insurance, eligibility for internal recruitment, seniority credit if hired full-time, shift differentials, and a process for appealing termination. These changes would help bring the treatment of on-call and temp workers into line with that of their regular status co-workers. But the county's offer would only apply to select classifications. It would only admit 95 of the current on-call and temp workers and exclude 219. In other words, it would leave out more than twice as many people as it would introduce. The county would be willing to recognize animal care aid workers, bridge operators, vet techs, facility security officers, workers in the libraries, and workers in the mental health crisis call center. Dozens of other classifications, including some of the largest ones like the office assistants that serve every department, wouldn't be. The would-be recognized workers, as well as other on-call and temp workers organizing for their union, have decided to not leave anyone behind. They're demanding that the county, their employer, recognize the on-call and temp workers as a whole. One way that you can help is to call the county chair's office, Deborah Cofori, at 503-988-3308 and demand that they recognize the union. That's County Chair Deborah Cofori's office at 503-988-3308. Demand that they recognize on-call and temp workers. For KBOO Community Radio and AFSCME Local 88, I'm Joe Clement.
All right. Thank you so much for that report there, Joe. And yeah, for those of you listening, it is very important that you do call Chair Cofori at the number just listed there. So please, if you have time tonight or tomorrow morning, please do give her a call. Let her know how you feel about that. Anyways, we are now just about out of time for this segment, this month's installment. Thank you so much for tuning in. One last thing I would like to say, though, editorializing a little bit here, but it's insane to watch in real time as we are basically watching the U.S. engage in regime change in the independent country of Venezuela and South America. You know, as a student of history, I've learned about the various, you know, the countless times that the U.S. has engaged in regime change through covert and overt means around the world, but we're watching it in real time. So please pay attention to that and let's get out there and stop the Trump administration from doing what would be a horrible thing for the people of Venezuela and the people of the United States and the rest of the world. So thank you again for listening. I am Michael Cathcart. You can find me on Twitter at Michael B. Cath, and reach out to me if you have any questions or want to talk about this stuff some more. Otherwise, I will talk to you all next month. Have a great night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Events Committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. Baby, you understand me now.